Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Andrea Gammel, registration number 32050, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Victor Hansen. I'm hoping to save about 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'll try to keep track myself as well. Your Honors, as I was walking over here this afternoon, I was hoping that it would be a little warmer and that I could suggest that we take this argument across the street into the park. And then I thought, well, just as well that it's not quite so warm, because that would be inappropriate, given the serious matter that we have to decide here today. And to the extent that it would have been inappropriate for us to hold this argument, even a public hearing in a public park, it was certainly inappropriate for the court in Mr. Hansen's case to allow the jury to deliberate and reach a verdict in a public park.
As a legal, what would prevent us from holding arguments in schools, we hold public places like that. Legally, what would prevent us from doing that?
Right. No, I think there's nothing legally that would prevent us. It would just be inappropriate because we would be distracted by various things around us: passersby, dogs, the weather, whether the grass is wet or not. The difference is, in Mr. Hansen's case, he was entitled to trial by jury, which contemplates a jury which deliberates the case in a private place, in secrecy. And that's not what happened in this case. And the record in this case is clear that not only were they in a public venue, but they were being watched by the court, the bailiff, defense counsel, and the prosecutor. And so I think in this case, first of all, I think this is really unprecedented. I haven't come up with any cases that deal with the circumstance of a jury deliberating in public. The attorney general in the answer brief doesn't have any cases either. And I think one of the reasons there's no cases on this is because it's so clearly wrong. We don't have juries deliberating public because it violates that sanctity of the deliberative process. And this is a concept, a core constitutional principle, that juries in criminal cases will deliberate in secret and in privacy, and that their verdicts will not be pried into. This is reflected in case law. It's reflected in our criminal code, which requires that the jury deliberate in a private place. And it's reflected by our rules of evidence.
Ms. Gammel, but is there any evidence in the record that the sanctity of the jury's deliberations, I mean, their conversation with each other, that was invaded?
They were being observed by the court, the bailiff, defense counsel, and the prosecutor. There's no question that they were being watched. Whether they were out of earshot or not, the court says we were all out of earshot, but they were being watched. And we know that they were being watched because that's how the court makes the record that nobody interfered with them. And defense counsel makes a further record that at one point he sees one of the jurors wandering away from the group, looking at his watch, talking on his cell phone, doing something. So we know that they're being observed. And I would submit that this is a situation similar to the one that occurred in Bullies, which is in the briefs, where the 13th juror, the alternate juror, is present in the jury room. And it's simply the presence of an unauthorized person. And in Bullies, we have an alternate juror who arguably is at least of the same peer group as the rest of the jury. But in this circumstance, we have the court, the parties, watching in on the jury as they go about their business.
The jury specifically asked if they could continue deliberations, didn't they?
The jury had concerns about time constraints amongst various jurors. There were some jurors that said they had weekend plans and couldn't deliberate on Saturday, because this was at the end of the day on Friday when this fire alarm happens and the courthouse is evacuated. They indicated to the judge, after talking about how they, you know, maybe couldn't come back on Saturday, maybe couldn't come back on Monday, that they just wanted to keep going. Defense counsel, who apparently had an office right across the street from the courthouse, on a number of occasions, according to the record, offered the conference room in his building for the jury to continue its deliberations. That would have been better. That would have been private.
It would have been in the defense counsel's chair. Wouldn't we be getting the same argument from your opposing counsel that, wait a minute, there's a lot of inherent pressure on this jury now because they're in defense counsel's office?
Well, I mean, that could be, but Probably, presumably not. There was no record that the prosecutor objected.
There's no record the defendant objected here either, right?
Well, I think by suggesting an alternative, and again, we're a little bit hamstrung given that this all occurred out in the parking lot. There's no contemporaneous record of what, who said what when, and what the process of it all was. This was all reconstructed the following Monday after the jury had reached its verdict out in the Butterfly Garden.
But we do have the court's reconstruction on Monday.
Right.
And nobody disagrees with that reconstruction, do they?
As far as the process, no.
And as far as what the trial court said happened during that period?
Right. The defense counsel makes a couple observations in addition to those made by the court, specifically the one about the juror who was concerned about meeting his family in the mountains and wandering away while the jury was doing, rest of the jurors were deliberating. But as far as they went out there, they indicated that they wanted to keep deliberating. My point is that it's not a typical record. We don't know if the judge said, oh, well, what about the Butterfly Garden? And defense counsel says, how about my conference room? Or something like that. You know, it's just the sequence of events is not particularly clear. Other than that, the court notes that it was a number of occasions that defense counsel offered.
But you would agree this is plain error review, though?
No, certainly not.
No? What was the objection to what the jury did? What was the contemporaneous objection?
I think by offering the alternative. Plain error review applies when something happens in the trial court and it's not brought to the attention of the court any sort of remedy or suggestion to the contrary. In this case, the issue came up, it was discussed by the parties, defense counsel offered an alternative, it was declined by the court, the court chose its own course of action. I think under those circumstances, the issue is well preserved for appellate review. And I would also say I'm not entirely sure that it would make any difference, because if you look at the Boulies case, which involves the circumstance of the 13th juror, the alternate juror being present, our Supreme Court notes that the presence of a third person in the jury room implicates the defendant's right to a fair trial to such an extent that it could only happen if the defendant actually made a personal waiver, knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of the right to jury trial before that could happen. And in that case, the Supreme Court was not concerned that defense counsel had not objected to this instruction permitting the alternate juror to sit in with the rest of the jury.
But given that on Monday, when the reconstructed record was made and defense counsel didn't say, you know, I want to state for the record my prior objection to the jury deliberating in this Butterfly Pavilion, why isn't that a waiver of the jury deliberating there?
Well, specifically, just under the Boulies case, it's not a waiver, because you can't presume a waiver from a silent record. And Boulies says under these circumstances, you need an actual express waiver by the defendant on the record, which we don't have in this case. We have, I would say, a preserved issue. And understandably, this has never come up before. So, you know, everyone's kind of, as the court described it, it's an ad hoc situation. Everyone's kind of going like the seat of their pants. The jury's in the middle of its deliberations. You know, everyone's hoping, you know, for the best result. And defense counsel's suggestion that they deliberate in his office is declined by the court. And are there other alternatives open to the court? To say, okay, why don't we all go get something to eat, you know, and come back here, see if this fire alarm's over in an hour, and then you can continue. Or simply order the jurors back on Monday, or declare a mistrial. There are many options other than permitting the jury to deliberate in a public area where they can be observed by other people, and were observed not just by other people, but by the parties themselves. And the inherently coercive nature of a jury being observed during, you know, doing its most important job of the whole trial.
What in the record indicates that there was some coercion felt by this jury from this circumstance? What can you point to in the record where anybody suggested that this jury was somehow interfered with?
It's under the Boulies case, it's presumed to be coercive. The simple presence of a third person, fourth, fifth, sixth person, or whatever we have in this case, observing the jury do its work is presumed to be prejudicial to the defendant.
You're equating a person in the jury room with someone standing 30 yards away.
I think so. I mean, when the court opens up the jury room to make it essentially anything that, I mean, if the court can see the jury can see the court. And same with defense counsel. So they're, you know, they're all seeing each other. I think it is the same. You know, once you open up the jury room into a public area, I think you run into the same situation. It would, you know, it would be no different if there was a large jury room and the court and the parties stood in the corner out of earshot, but within eyesight, that would not be acceptable. So the fact that the court permits this to happen outside, I don't think makes any difference as to whether it's, you know, we're looking at a constrained room or whether we're looking at simply being observed. Now, in the brief, I talk about that this is an error that I think should be reviewed under structural error analysis because there are so many external factors that might come into play that it would be impossible, particularly given our rules of evidence, to determine what sort of psychological or other effect deliberating outside might have on a jury. And so, again, I would just urge this court to review under a structural error analysis, which doesn't require a showing of prejudice on the part of the defense. This is just an error that can't be quantified. The harm can't be quantified. It is a framework type error appropriate for structural error review. And then I would say, alternatively, the analysis in Boolies where prejudice is presumed when the third party is allowed to observe jury deliberations. And then once the prejudice is presumed, the burden shifts to the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that error is harmless beyond reasonable doubt. So I would just say this is an exceptionally unique situation, and I don't think the court should be feel constrained in finding that this was error or even structural error because it's unlikely that this would ever happen again. It appears to have never happened before. This is not a floodgate type situation where the court would issue a decision that would, you know, allow all kinds of other structural error type analyses. This is really a unique situation and appropriate for structural error analysis. I have 2 minutes left if I may reserve my time. Good, thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Gillespie. My registration number is 26109, and I'm here representing the people of the state of Colorado this afternoon. First, I would like to point out to the court that we have to keep the facts consistent with what we have in the record. First of all, this was not a public place. The defendant has a right to have a jury deliberate in a private and convenient place. The cases that I cited in my brief talk about the fact that that doesn't have to be the jury room, it can be a hotel room. But I think what's important to talk about here is there was clearly no objection from the defendant, just flat out no objection. In fact, he didn't even make much of a record on this until almost a month after the reconstruction the next day. Kind of in between accepting the jury verdict and sentencing is when he filed his motion for a new trial. The trial court, who did make a very specific reconstruction on that Monday morning, indicated that, as this court has already recognized, that the jury was asking to continue to deliberate. They had asked not to take breaks earlier in the evening when they were given that opportunity. The court says that this place where they were asked or directed to was down a small hill and out of earshot and eyesight of all the people that were standing around, including the court and the parties. Now, defense counsel in her brief and in her argument states that there was this juror during deliberations that was using his cell phone. However, when you look at the record, that juror was on his cell phone as they were proceeding to go down into this area where they were going to deliberate. So I think that there are liberties being taken with what the actual facts of this record provide this court. And I think if this court looks at that, and that's on volume 8, page 11, I think if you look at that, the bailiff took an oath that they would not let anybody disturb the jury. The trial court and reminded the bailiff of that and instructed the bailiff to stay out of earshot. This is a very different case than a 13th juror, an alternate juror, sitting in and listening to deliberations. But even in that case, it wasn't structural error. They still looked at the harm that could be associated with that. So I don't think there's any basis for finding that it's structural error, and I won't address that unless the court is inclined to hear more on that particular issue. I do think it's a plain error analysis in this particular case. I would agree that it is a unique circumstance. However, I could see it happening over again, having been in the trial court for years, that these kind of things do pop up. And I think in this case, the trial court, to the best of its ability, allowed the jury to continue deliberating, found a place that was neutral, and stated to the parties that it needed to be a neutral place, put them away from ear and eye shot, and then had the bailiff resume his or her responsibility as it would be in the courtroom. And another point in the brief, the defendant states that, you know, the defendant himself was allowed to wander over by the jury during deliberations, but again, taking liberties with the facts as they're presented in the record. That was while everybody was standing around waiting to kind of see what was going to happen. That's no different than the inconsequential meeting of a defendant who passes by a member of the jury in the hallways of the courtroom or in the cafeteria. The important thing here is the private and confidential nature of the deliberations themselves. And I think in this particular case, there is no evidence presented on the record that they were interfered with. There is no evidence presented on the record that they were given any extraneous information. The defendant had ample opportunity to supplement the record, both at the reconstruction and in his motion for new trial. And if the court looks very carefully at the facts, there is nothing to indicate that anybody was observing the jury while it was deliberating. And I don't have the record cite for it, but I remember them indicating that the trial judge indicating that he could just kind of see the tops of heads down in this private place. So there's no indication that the prosecutor, defense attorney, defendant are all staring at this jury while they're deliberating. So if there's nothing else on any of the issues that the court's concerned with, I don't really have anything else for my argument.
Gillespie, can you address for me why we shouldn't be concerned or bothered by the fact that the trial court didn't hold a hearing on whether the additional evidence about other accusations made by the victim, why he shouldn't have at least allowed a hearing on those issues?
I think the Rice case addresses that, Judge, and the Rice case very clearly states that even a rape shield hearing can be used for the purpose of humiliating a victim, and even putting them through the questioning of a rape shield hearing needs to be done very carefully, and there needs to be a threshold that the defendant has to meet. And in order to meet that threshold, the defendant has to file an appropriate offer of proof. The offer of proof that was filed in this case, there's just no stretch of the imagination that would make that an appropriate offer of proof. It was based on hearsay. There was no evidence of any anticipated testimony. All of the unsubstantiated claims, and I'm going to refer to them by initials, by ND, there was nothing to indicate that she had firsthand knowledge of that. There was no interview done with these alleged, the person that she accused. So there was nothing in there that would have amounted to anticipated testimony. It was one woman's opinion that she had 15, 16, 17 years ago accused some person of something, and that this particular woman who was making these allegations didn't believe that those allegations were true. There was no relevancy or purpose of the testimony that was argued in the offer of proof as to how these would be relevant. And most importantly, there were no facts given in that offer of proof that showed how they were going to get that information into evidence. None of the statements in that offer of proof, this woman would not have been allowed to be a witness in this case to talk about double and triple hearsay about what this alleged, about what the victim in this case may or may not have done 15, 16, and 17 years ago. And I think what the Weiss case indicates for this court is that they have to meet that threshold. If there's not a threshold on this offer of proof, then there's really no point on this prong to the rape shield statute, because it is still going to allow defense attorneys to throw mud and see what sticks. And I think Weiss did a very good job of laying out that there are certain thresholds that an offer of proof has to make. And a defense investigator's interview with a lay witness about what she thinks or may have heard. You know, one of the allegations was that the victim in this case had accused a sheriff's deputy. There was no name of the sheriff's deputy. There was no interview with the sheriff's deputy to indicate that he had been. There was no time or date alleged as to when that took place. And so I think in this particular case, the offer of proof was just insufficient. And I think the trial court did a very good job of holding the defense attorney to that burden of having a sufficient offer of proof before even granting the rape shield statute hearing. And that's what the statute requires, is the court only has to hold that hearing if the offer of proof is sufficient. And it wasn't here. If the court doesn't have any other questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just briefly, I had to mention when I first stood up that Mr. Hansen has been released on an appeal bond. He's been on appeal bond for almost a year. And while he wanted to be here for the argument today, he has a job which currently has him in Trinidad putting out a coal fire. And so I should note that his non-attendance today is not because he's not interested in the case. It's because the nature of the work and its location didn't permit his attendance at the argument. And again, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I would just again stress that the issue in this case is not this is not a plain air review with respect to the deliberations. When defense counsel offers an alternative and it's declined by the court, that preserves the issue for appeal. A similar situation would be if defense counsel offered, for example, an alternative jury instruction.
Well, let me ask you, why wouldn't it be the same if the defense lawyer offered 10 different alternatives? How would we know which one he really wanted us to review until we get up on appeal and you're arguing one of the 10?
Well, because
how do we know?
Well, but we're arguing the error is the court's decision to choose the course that it did. So if defense counsel had offered any number of alternatives, would not make the issue any more or less preserved than if he just offered one, because the court ultimately declined the one that he did offer. And if he had suggested, well, let's take a break and all, you know, and come back later, I don't think that would make any difference, because the court was set upon, apparently, this decision to allow the court to deliberate, or to allow the jury to deliberate in the garden. I see my time is up. I would ask the court to reverse the convictions for alternatively based on the first issue raised in the brief.
Thank you for your arguments. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you.